Hello and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway, and in today's program, we'll again be drawing from Tom Minnery's book, Why You Can't Stay Silent. Specifically, in this week's program, we're going to be addressing the debate over the role of church and state. That's always a controversial topic. And the call on each of us to shine your light and embrace your world. In addition, we're just going to be reviewing a little bit some of the things that we've been discussing in past programs from Tom Minnery as he talks about the challenge that each of us has to speak out for virtue and to speak out against evil wherever and whenever it raises its ugly head. Rita, take it from here. Chapter 5 of Tom Minnery, Why You Can't Stay Silent.
Well, let's just dive right in, Dean, because we have a lot to cover, as you've mentioned. Minnery begins chapter 5 of the book on churches and Caesar by pointing out that our secular civil government today in America has boldly assumed the prerogatives of the church to declare moral truth, and that the church has both reason and obligation to speak out on these issues. This chapter of the book, I think, is really a significant challenge to pastors, but I have to say I think it is really dead on. Minnery points out that while many pastors cringe at the idea of involving their church in politics, these same pastors will and do swing right into action when and if their own church is actually threatened by some government action.
Well, and Rita, we have some examples of that. I think of a movement in Colorado several years ago when the government talked about removing tax exemptions from nonprofit organizations, including churches. The church swung into action.
That one hit close to home, didn't it?
Then there was another example when a local government allowed a sexually oriented business, we refer to them as SOBs, to move in next door to the church. And it's in these real-life situations, when the church feels itself threatened, that it tends to respond immediately in order to protect themselves.
Right. And the point that Minnery makes from this is that it is very self-serving and actually unloving for a church to have this position where they're only going to enter the public arena if their own interests are actually at stake, right?
Well, that is a human tendency, isn't it? Yeah. And I recall an earlier chapter, we didn't refer to this yet, but Jesus used the parable of the Good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. When it's a passerby who had no interest in this poor guy lying in the ditch, nevertheless, he took action to help that man out. And he uses that as a model for us, not just to protect our self-interest, but to protect the health, the safety, the welfare of our neighbor made in the image of God.
Absolutely.
And then, in this chapter that you're discussing right now, Minnery goes on to discuss a few scriptures that underscore the importance of the influence of God's people, not only on their immediate neighbors, but on the nation's well-being.
Right.
I'd like to read a few of those now, and it goes back to a reference we made last week to righteousness and the importance of righteousness, referred to 515 times in the Bible. The first scripture I'd like to refer to is from, actually, they're all from Proverbs, all three of them.
Yeah.
The first one is from Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. There's that word sin that we hear so infrequently in today's culture. Sin is a reproach to any people. The second one, also from Proverbs chapter 11, verse 11, it says, oh, I love this verse. Through the blessing of the upright, a city is exalted, but by the mouth of the wicked, it is destroyed. And I think, Rita, when we're making an application to America today, we find that the blessing of the upright is increasingly silent.
Yes.
And but the mouth of the wicked is increasingly vocal and strident.
Yes.
Well, then that takes us to the third reference in Proverbs chapter 29, verse 2. When the righteous thrive, the people rejoice. But when the wicked rule, the people groan. And Rita, I hear a lot of groaning going around in our culture today.
You know, that one, that last one in particular, says a lot about the situation in America today, where not only do we see the righteous not necessarily thriving, we see them being punished for standing up for their beliefs. We see them mocked, ridiculed, and pushed to the side and alienated from public life. Those three verses, I think, say so much about how important it is for godly men and women to run for public office at every level, Dean. I'm not just talking about running for president. I'm talking about running for school board, city council, at every level of government. We need godly men and women. And then the flip side of that is that we need other godly people to help them get elected.
That's right.
What I think is so important for us to realize is that as Christians in America, we have a heightened obligation to be actively involved in what is happening in our government. Because just as we discussed when we did the program on the Declaration of Independence, America was founded on the principle that our government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed.
Now, who's the governed here that we're talking about?
Well, that's us, Dean.
Hmm.
If the government does the things it does on the premise of our consent, Rita Dunaway's consent, then we are responsible for what it is doing. And that is a huge responsibility for all of us.
Rita, that really highlights, I think, a misunderstanding of God's sovereignty. We've been studying God's sovereignty in our home group, and I think while we recognize God's sovereignty, it is often misunderstood to mean that God is going to take care of all of our problems, and we don't have a responsibility for them. We referred to this prayer last week in our program, a prayer that we often hear, that we got these problems, but I'm tired and I really don't feel up to the task. God, will you please come down and fix it? That's what I think is misunderstood as God's sovereignty. He is control. I have to say that I know a dairy farmer who will not vote because God is sovereign. I just have to ask him, well, who milks your cows in the morning? You're not expecting him to do it, are you? And so God has delegated this responsibility to us. So our response really, as we said again last week, the prayer of Isaiah, Lord, here am I, send me.
Okay, Dean, so I'm a Christian and I vote. I'm done, right?
No. The simple answer is no.
Okay.
And you've already talked about a calling on godly men and women to actually run for public office. This is not an easy assignment. You sacrifice time with your family. You sacrifice your own privacy. It is not an easy assignment, but it is a call on us to be active. You mentioned several ways. And here's what Minnery says, actually, about this. Quote, the proper role for the Christian citizen is to participate in government as fully as his calling and skills can take him, whether it be limited to voting or as active government leaders. And I think, Rita, and you've alluded to this, it means finding people and including offering yourself to run for public office. And then once you've identified capable, qualified people, you support them, you campaign for them, you help them financially. These are expensive campaigns. There's so many things that we can do, door knocking, making telephone calls, talking to our friends, asking our church if we can have voter guides in the lobby of the church to help distinguish the differences between the candidates for a particular public office.
And also, Dean, being in the ear of our elected officials who are godly men and women in office to encourage them and support them in practical ways and embolden them to go to battle for godly principles. And you know, Dean, this actually reminds me of a time when you and I together met with one of our area public officials, and we were urging him to stand up and to be a leader for a godly public policy that we were working on. And he said to us, maybe you don't remember, tell me if you remember this. He said to us, Dean and Rita, I don't know if I'm going to do it or not, but I can tell you that I need people like you to constantly be in my ear urging me to do things like this. Do you remember that?
I don't remember it. I'll take your word for it, but I know many legislators would feel this way. Yeah. And here's my comment on that, Rita. Often I see a controversial issue coming up before our elected legislators. And often I have two reactions. Well, I don't need to contact our own Valley legislators because I know they'll do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And yet, as you said, they need to hear from us. Yes. They are human. They need our encouragement. Yes. So encourage those who are doing the right thing. And then I have another reaction. That's from those who oppose this good legislation. I say, hey, they are beyond hope. They are deaf to reason. There's no point wasting my time to urge them to vote the right way. I think we have to overcome both of those reactions. We need to be involved. And I remember hearing it said, I don't know how accurate this is or the exact number, but one letter or one telephone call may represent 20 other people or 100 other people. Yeah. They say, well, if this person is concerned, there must be 100 friends and neighbors like him who are concerned. And so we just need to, and especially from pastors, I'll say especially from pastors, they are sitting in authority or standing in authority over congregations of 50, 100, 500, and 1,000. When a pastor speaks, his voice is amplified.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we could go on about this all day, but here's one I know you will remember.
Yes.
When we heard the powerful elected official, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee in the General Assembly, on the floor of the House one day, he mentioned the fact that if he receives, I think the number he gave was 12 emails or phone calls on an issue, he knows that it's something people are passionate about, and he sits up and takes notice. And my two responses to that were, first of all, it's really a shame that we are at a point where only 12 people contact him, and that is considered to be a huge outpouring of support. On the other hand, what an opportunity for us. Can you imagine if a whole congregation contacted someone about an issue?
Rita, everything that you're saying, I say amen to. But I have another response to that. Where is the internal conviction and conscience of our elected officials? Why are they not driven by their accountability before God rather than swayed by the fickle voice of culture? Yes, it's important. I don't mean to dismiss what you've just said, but we need, first of all, to elect public officials who are guided by their responsibility before God to do what is right and to fight what is wrong. And so it's both and, it's not either or.
Well, and that takes us right back to Minnery, and I want to read another quote from this chapter of his book. He says this, "When the sparks fly over moral issues in the councils of government, how much more effective it is and honoring to Christ to have skilled Christian people at the center of the debate in full possession of the facts and a record of public trust."
Yes.
End quote.
Yes.
And you know, that is so true. I think of the situation, Dean, in Virginia a few years ago when the pro-life community, including the Forum, was urging the Board of Health to adopt more stringent health and safety standards for abortion clinics. This was after it became clear that in some of those clinics, women's health was truly endangered because of the unsanitary conditions and unsafe practices. So many Christians from all denominations showed up in Richmond and testified at the public meetings or even wrote letters that they submitted online to the board. All of that was absolutely essential. But just think, Dean, about how much influence just a handful of God-fearing men and women can have by actually being on the board, being the decision maker.
Yes.
And putting the health and safety of people above all the politics and the just naked desire to make abortion as quick and easy as possible, no matter what the cost. And I know that we did have at that time at least a handful of God-fearing members of that board.
Well, and I'm going to go right back to voting matters. You said, I voted, is that all I need to do? Yes, voting is important. And this gets right back to that abortion clinic debate that you mentioned before the Board of Health. And that is that, yes, there are godly men and women who would like to serve on that board, but unless you elect a governor who will identify godly men and women, he is going to put people on that board who think that we ought to have unlimited rights to abortion, to kill the unborn child. So it's not only the willingness of people to serve, but the election of the top of the government, our governor, our lieutenant governor, and to be represented by an attorney general who will defend these practices.
Don't even get me started.
Oh, dear.
On that, Dean.
Okay. Well, I have to share, though, and I think our listeners know what we're talking about here. We're not naming names, but we know that we need a change in our government if we're going to have a change in our policies and in our culture.
Or even just the rule of law.
Now, don't get me started. So I have to share here, Rita, another great Minnery quote in this section. He says, quote, Christianity is no mere protest movement. In our country, the blessings of liberty were secured for all, and Christian people have equal opportunity to set good public policy, not merely to protest after bad policy has been set. And here, Rita, how many times do we find ourselves weeping or complaining about bad public policies? I hear it all the time. I hear myself groaning and moaning in my bed in the morning. Why even bother getting up? This place is going to hell in a handbasket.
Poor Janet.
Yeah, well, that's right. She doesn't sleep very well at night. And that is the very reason why we started the Valley Family Forum, as you know, Rita, to inform and to mobilize people into doing something about public policy rather than just complain about it. And I've said from the very beginning, if we can't do it in the Valley, we don't deserve God's mercy. We have a task to perform, and we need to get about the business.
Yeah, well, let's go back to churches for a moment,
okay.
Dean. It's so unfortunate, I think, that some pastors have this idea that they can just sit out the culture wars. But if and when the government subjects the church itself to some trial or tribulation, at that point they think their congregation will have the strength to resist, even to the point of being jailed or having their property taken away. And Tom Minnery in this chapter has very strong words for this kind of pastor. In his view, such a pastor has failed in his role of protector of his flock. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that, Dean.
Well, Rita, if we look around, we can see that our religious liberty is under direct assault in so many ways. The situation has become much, much worse since Minnery wrote this book back in 2001. We've talked before on this program, and I'm not going to repeat in detail, but we have bakers, we have florists, photographers, painters, and printers. The list goes on. People who have lost legal battles that ensued when they refused to provide services for same-sex wedding ceremonies that violated their faith.
And you know, Dean, just recently in the news, it was a real shame. The courts left standing this decision upholding the state of Washington's regulations on pharmacists that required all pharmacists to be willing to administer the Plan B abortion drug. Now more than ever, we are desperate for churches to encourage and embolden their congregations to stand up for righteousness and against evil. And there will be a cost, but we must do it. And to do that well, Christians must work toward changing the policies and structures of government that perpetuate evil and obscure good. Let's not just wait till after the fact. Let's get in there and rework and change the policies.
Well, I think of another shameful Supreme Court decision when they overruled the state of Texas when they tried to improve abortion clinics' health and safety standards. It's just out of whack. But let's get back to Mittery. Okay. He takes a long, hard look at the passage in Matthew where Jesus tells his disciples that they are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. He examines the idea held by many Christians that this simply means they should strive for personal righteousness and try to be a good influence on the people around them. Well, Mittery suggests it actually means something much more dramatic than that. Because if we are simply coasting along in the midst of a society that is decaying and growing morally dark, we are failing in our call to be salt and light. Because salt penetrates in order to preserve, and light conquers the darkness. That is our call.
Well, now we've come to it, Dean, the inevitable.
Let's get to it.
The part when someone in the audience raises his hand and says, "What about the separation of church and state? You have to keep religion and politics separate." So I will respond by first pointing out that the phrase "separation of church and state" is not in the Constitution. The First Amendment forbids the establishment of a national religion and protects individual religious liberty. And while these clauses of the First Amendment have certainly been twisted over time, we can and have done full programs on that, it is absolute nonsense to suggest that there is some prohibition against being motivated by one's faith to enter the public square and argue for public policies that are consistent with God's commands. To make this point further, Dean, I'd like to quote from one of my favorite of the late Justice Scalia's dissenting opinions. This one was in the case Edwards versus Aguilar, dealing with a Louisiana law that required balanced treatment of the theory of evolution with the theory of intelligent design. So Scalia said this: "Our cases in no way imply that the Establishment Clause forbids legislators merely to act upon their religious convictions. We surely would not strike down a law providing money to feed the hungry or shelter the homeless if it could be demonstrated that but for the religious beliefs of the legislators, the funds would not have been approved. Also, political activism by the religiously motivated is part of our heritage. Notwithstanding the majority's implication to the contrary, we do not presume that the sole purpose of a law is to advance religion merely because it was supported strongly by organized religions or by adherents of particular faiths. To do so would deprive religious men and women of their right to participate in the political process." He said, "Today's religious activism may give us the Balanced Treatment Act, but yesterday's resulted in the abolition of slavery, and tomorrow's may bring relief for famine victims," end quote.
Well, Rita, I think that really brings it into focus. The Establishment Clause has been misinterpreted to say that this wall of separation that we hear about so often means that the church cannot speak to the government. In fact, this separation of church and state Establishment Clause was aimed at preventing the government to intruding on the church.
That's right.
The voice of the church is desperately needed in our culture and to our government today.
Yeah. Well, Dean, in addition to the ridiculous idea that the Constitution forbids Christians from political action motivated by their faith, we also frequently hear people say, "You can't legislate morality," and that Christians should not, quote unquote, impose their beliefs on everyone else. Would you comment on those ideas
for
us?
Yes, just two comments, Rita. Yes, it's true we can't change the human heart through legislation, but we certainly can legislate moral behavior. Let's take slavery as an example.
Yes.
Secondly, we legislate morality all the time. You can't murder, you can't steal, you can't lie under oath. With regard to the accusation that we're imposing beliefs on others, every law imposes somebody's belief about what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad on the rest of our society. And as Mittery points out, if anyone is imposing beliefs in a tyrannical sense, it is the public officials who have at times illegitimately removed decision-making power from the people. That is tyranny, that is despotism, and that is imposition unintended by our Constitution.
And I think you're referring to the Supreme Court in cases like Roe versus Wade, where it has reinterpreted the Constitution in order to create some right that is not actually there. The effect of actions like those are to remove the issue from public debate where it should be.
Well, we could talk about the Supreme Court at considerable length, but there's another case I think that we have to refer. That's June 26 of 2015, the Obergefell versus Hodges, to overturn the laws in over 30 states and dictate that they have to recognize same-sex unions as marriages.
That's tyranny.
That's tyranny.
I know we're coming to the end of the program, Dean, and I'd just like to share this quote I found from a pastor named Shane Eidelman in California, and it's his response to the statement that the gospel doesn't allow for politics. It's not our mission. And what he says is this: God has blessed and sustained America because of our spiritual foundation. Should we now neglect it? Why would God ordain a government such as ours in America and not ask us to be involved? Although my primary calling is preaching, I thank God for Christians who are involved and who influence America's political climate. I wish that there were more. As the moral and cultural war rages between our shores, they need to be awakened from our spiritual slumber has never been greater. And he quotes Martin Luther, "Where the battle rages, there the loyalty of the soldier is tested." And he finishes by saying, "This battle is for the very soul of our nation. It's our choice, stand or fall."
This has been very helpful to me just to go over all of this material. I would just like to make two comments. One is, I love the Manhattan Declaration that was drafted in 2009, talks about the importance of life, marriage, and religious liberty. And here's what it says about the separation of church and state. "We will fully and ungrudgingly render to Caesar what is Caesar's, but under no circumstances will we render to Caesar what is God's." And let me just say, for listeners who'd like to know more about Minery, you can go to Amazon to order this book. They have them there for a penny. If you'd like to order that, just go to Amazon.com.
Thank you, Dean. And that does bring our program to a close for today. If anyone would like to listen to this program again or share it with friends, they can just go to our website at valleyfamilyforum.org and click on the link to Crossroads, which is on our homepage. I want to thank two of our great sponsors, Blue Ridge Chimney Services and the dental practice of Scott Dunaway. Check them out and let them help you with your chimney or your teeth. As always, we're deeply grateful for your prayers, your encouragement, and your generous financial support. And I want to just read briefly a note of support that came in. I'm not going to identify the author, but they wrote, "We are keeping Crossroads in our prayers. This program has been a great blessing to our community. Keep the good work going, and blessings to all." And again, we do thank you for your notes and also for your financial support. If you want to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can send a check to P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia, 22803. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rita Dunaway with Dean Welty and our engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. Until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.
Rejoice, 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 rej